I have a vivid memory of the first time I walked into Key Arena to watch the Seattle Supersonics play the LA Clippers on November 7th, 1995. The second game since the Seattle Center Coliseum had been renovated. Key Arena seemed so nice and new back then. You've got to understand, at age 13, the places I'd been to for games were the old Coliseum, built in 1962 for the World's Fair, Husky Stadium, which was 7 decades old, and the Kingdome. Compared to them, the Key seemed like a palace. Within 7 years, the Sonics would be agitating for another renovation or a new building. Within 13, they would be in Oklahoma City. And now, 23 short, or long, years later, the Key is set for the wrecking ball when the Oakview Group begins a $750 million rebuild that will result in essentially a new building at the same location and with the same iconic roof. I'm Kevin Pelton, and in this special episode of the Fabulous Peltoncast, we'll explore the entire history of Key Arena, how a seemingly new building could become outdated so quickly, and the memories that were made by the Sonics, the Seattle Storm, and a number of other teams at the Key. When the Sonics first moved in, the Key seemed exciting and new for them too. After all, they'd spent the previous season playing at the Tacoma Dome, about a half hour south of Seattle Center by I-5 under light traffic, and a far longer commute during rush hour even back in 1995. By comparison, Key Arena was a welcome alternative. Here's longtime Seattle sports columnist Steve Kelly on the Tacoma Dome.
The thing that made Key Arena palatable was the fact that they're coming from Tacoma Dome. You look at those locker rooms and think that a major sports team had that as their home locker room in 1995. It wasn't that long ago. You know, it was 20 years ago, roughly. And it was hideous. There wasn't a good seat in the house. We were kind of like by Gig Harbor, I think, sitting in our seats. And so, yeah, going into Key Arena was like, all right, we're back in the big leagues.
The Sonics head coach at the time, George Carl, felt playing Tacoma disadvantaged the Sonics from a competitive standpoint.
And probably the one thing I remember about it, how miserable it was playing in Tacoma for 1 year. I mean, playing 82 road games is probably not a smart thing to do, but we fought through it. But again, I thought it really affected us in the playoffs that year, too.
To longtime Sonics guard Nate McMillan, returning to the renovated Key felt like coming to a new arena.
Yeah, because, you know, I had played in the old building, Seattle Center, and, it was old and outdated. And, you know, we felt like we were getting a new arena, you know, so the color scheme was different. You know, we went from the old uniforms to the new uniforms, and, the colors in the building was different. The bowl that they had dug down and went a little deeper. So it felt like, felt bigger. It felt more intimate, and we felt like, you know, we had a new arena, and we wanted to make that a difficult place to play. And I thought we did.
Here's Carl on the Sonics' first season in Key Arena.
I think everybody was excited. I mean, it was a situation where we knew we had to have a great year, and the building was fresh. The fans were into it, and I think the team responded at a high level.
There's such a buzz.
Here's Kelly again.
There was, you know, they played the right kind of music during the timeouts. It was a thrill to be in there. And, yeah, they look at their record. I mean, that's not going to happen here for a long, long time.
I think we had one good homestand where we won 37 or 38 games. That makes the rest of the season pretty easy.
Indeed, during the Sonics' first season at Key Arena, they went 38-3. Just 9 teams in NBA history have ever won more home games. As Carl alluded, the Sonics needed it. They were coming off back-to-back losses in the first round as the better seed, including becoming the first number one seed ever to lose as a number 8 in 1994 in the final game played at the Coliseum. Carl narrowly survived the playoff disappointments, and the organization's patience was rewarded with a banner 1995-96 season. The Sonics won a franchise record 64 games and were again the number one seed in the Western Conference. This time, they survived a first-round scare from the Sacramento Kings and swept the two-time defending champion Houston Rockets in the following round, setting up one of the biggest series and games at the Key, Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals against the Utah Jazz, with a chance to play the Chicago Bulls in the NBA Finals on the line. Carl.
But I mean, we had a lot of great memories against Utah. Utah was a team that we battled all those years. I was in Seattle. Sloan was just, with Malone and Stockton, they were right next to us almost every year. And I think they beat us my first year in Seattle, and we beat them in the year that we went. I think the year we lost to Phoenix, they beat us. We beat them. And so, we had a marvelous competition between those two teams, and it was fun to...
Well, that's where I would start, and I probably would end there.
Here's McMillan again.
Hey, that was, because Utah was a elite team during that time. It was a big time battle with those guys every year. Stockton and Malone were, somewhere, right near their prime. So they were a tough opponent.
Wally Walker, then the Sonics GM, puts Game 7 against Utah at the top of his list of Key Arena highlights.
I don't know. I think going back to favorite memories, I think I got Game 7 against Utah. When you now think back at how good Utah was with two of the probably 10 best players in the history of the NBA and other good players around them, and that building being on fire in the way it was, and great plays and great players, I don't think it gets better than that.
Kelly remembers the game in the series.
The Utah series, when you really think about it, was boring up until Game 7. Almost every game was a blowout, and I think a lot of fans around here thought, well, Game 7, we'll just follow the same script and blow the Jazz out, and we're in the finals. And that game was unbelievable. I mean, I just saw, I was watching something else, and I clicked over to the NBA Network, and they had that game on. And I had forgotten that the Sonics were behind a lot of that game. And there was, that's the other thing about Key Arena. There was like this collective nervousness about, oh, my God, it isn't going to happen.
Here's Carl.
I don't think I've ever played a closer game in my life, and it was not a close game, but it was a close series. And last minute to go in the game, we posted Sean up. He got fouled. He made two free throws, and they posted Malone up. He got fouled. He missed two free throws, and that was basically the difference in the outcome of the game. Maybe us making the two free throws first was the reason we won.
He also has a distinct memory of how much noise the Key Arena crowd made during Game 7.
I just know that I walked out of that game, and I think it was a Sunday afternoon game, and I remember walking to a restaurant nearby. I don't know where we went, but we were walking to a restaurant, and my ears were ringing. My ears were ringing outside. So, it was like I didn't have a headache or anything, but it was obviously the noise was at a decibel level that was probably not healthy for my eardrums.
For the first time since winning the 1979 championship, the Sonics were headed to the NBA Finals, where they'd face a Bulls team that had set an NBA record by going 72-10 during the regular season. After their playoff upsets, the Sonics were thrilled to be there. Maybe a little too thrilled. Here's Carl.
The one thing I love about that is, not many players ever get to the NBA Finals. Not many coaches can get to the NBA Finals. And it was just a celebration, and we probably celebrated too much and lost the first three games against Chicago and then started playing pretty well.
McMillan concurs.
I think it just drained so much out of us, that seven-game series against those guys, that once we got into the finals, we were pretty happy about reaching the finals, that we really didn't have, enough to go up against Chicago. They were the favorites. They had experience being getting to the finals, and we really didn't have enough. I was injured, and I thought the Utah series kind of drained us.
The Sonics were competitive in the first two games in Chicago, but were down 0-2 as they headed home for Game 3. I was thrilled. Our family had gotten season tickets when the Sonics moved into Key Arena, but my brother Tristan and I split one ticket, and he'd gotten to go to Game 7 against the Jazz. Now I was going to an NBA Finals game. Or so I thought. The morning of Game 3, our mom couldn't find the tickets, which she'd hidden for safekeeping. The young listener might be thinking, what's the problem? Just print out new ones at home. But this was 1996. We didn't have the internet yet. And even if we did, the only way to replace the tickets was to file a police report stating they'd been stolen. I talked Mom out of doing that, and she kept looking. By the time she finally found them and we got to Key Arena, it was halftime, and the Sonics were down 24 points. They'd make a push after halftime, but still lost 108-86, putting the Bulls a game away from the sweep. Kelly thought the series was over.
Yeah, I mean, I went to game four thinking, all right, this isn't going to be much fun. But
the Sonics had a surprise in store. McMillan, who hadn't played in the first three games of the series due to a debilitating back injury, was going to play.
I wanted to get out on the floor. I did whatever I could to try to get out on the floor. I ended up taking two cortisone injections and within a month period trying to play on the floor. And normally that is not allowed, but I wanted to try to get out there. And I really felt like I could help us win. And, you know, that cortisone injection, it worked, helped for, you know, a short period of time, and was able to get out there and play a few minutes. We won two games, but I really just couldn't play. I mean, that back at that time was so painful that, you know, I was, you know, questioning my faith and everything. You know, why is it happening to me in this, you know, this moment of, you know, this is the biggest moment of my career. Having the opportunity to play in the NBA Finals, and I'm here experiencing back issue or back pain that I don't know where it came from. It was just, it was excruciating pain. And
when McMillan checked in off the bench in Game 4, he received an enormous standing ovation from the Key Arena crowd.
I remember the song and everything they played.
Oh, Return of the Mac.
It was... Return of the Mac, yeah. And, you know, I think that song had come out that year or something, and whoever came up with that was like, I mean, it was just, you know, really neat that they, you know, pulled that out and played it, and I'm stepping on the floor, and, you know, that adrenaline really... helped me to play the few minutes that I played, because I really was in a lot of pain. And, you know, as I mentioned, I took that injection. So really from my waist down, I was pretty numb, you know, trying to block the pain, and was able to play a few minutes and, you know, help the team. But, you know, the crowd was just amazing.
Here's Carl on the lift McMillan's return provided.
Huge. I mean, you know, he was our mental leader. He was our glue guy. He was, you know, he had a toughness to him that gave us another defender on the court. Not only a defender, but a guy that could create steals and deflections that we were hungry for at the time. I mean, I think someone told me that, I think Nate played in 9 quarters and we won 8 of them or something like that. You know, I never knew that stat, but if that stat's true, it's probably obviously that we had a confidence when Nate was on the court that we probably didn't have. But, you know, we were still a damn good team. But he was the guy that probably, if healthy, would have maybe gotten us over the top, at least gotten us to Game 7.
And I remember a lot of people wrote Willis Reed kind of equating that with Nate.
Here's Kelly.
And I remember Phil Jackson just kind of snickering at that because he was on that Knicks team. And, oh, he was no, you know, he's, no, I know Willis Reed, and Nate McMillan is not Willis Reed. But he was in that game. And I mean, I can't even imagine how he played because, you know, we saw him all week every time getting ready for a game. And
the Sonics would go on to win both games 4 and 5 at home, sending the series back to Chicago.
Game 6 back in Chicago, those guys thought, the Sonics thought they were going to win. I mean, you know, Gary was calling Michael an old man, and I got this old man. And I think they really thought they were going to win it. But alas.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that's the other thing about Key Arena. You can always look at it as a but alas. You know, Ray Allen misses the jumper from the corner in Game 6 against San Antonio. Game 6. And just a lot of them. You know, it would have been fun to have a couple championship banners hanging in there.
The 1996 finals would prove a high point for the 90s Sonics. Though they won the Pacific Division again the following season, they slipped to third in the West and lost to the Rockets in the second round in seven games. That would be Sean Kemp's last game in a Sonics uniform. That summer, he was traded in a three-team deal that netted the Sonics Vin Baker as a replacement. In a last hurrah, the Sonics went 61-21 in Baker's first season in Seattle, but lost again in the second round to the LA Lakers, who won the final four games of the series after losing at Game 1 at the Key. This time, it was Carl who departed, his contract not renewed, and an era was over. Kelly remembers.
When it went south quickly and ugly. I mean, yeah, again, I think, talk about Barry, I think the thing that he regretted...
That's Barry Ackerley, the team's owner during this span.
...or was most angry about was that this team couldn't stay together. And, I mean, it was a... The fun of those guys was they were such different personalities. You know, Hersey Hawkins couldn't be more opposite than Vincent Askew. Sam Perkins can't be more opposite than Detlef Schrempf. And Schrempf can't be more opposite than Sean Kemp. I mean, they're all really different guys who somehow came together on the floor. But, you know, if you look in hindsight, it's easy to see how it couldn't sustain itself. Yeah. And, well, and remember, at that point, George and Wally weren't speaking. Well, George was speaking. Wally wasn't. George was speaking to everybody but Wally. And, yeah, I mean, it got ugly in a hurry. The whole thing, the whole Sean Kemp, Gary Payton team kind of was like a lightning bolt. It you know, lit up the sky for two or three years and just fizzled.
Though the Sonics remained competitive, reaching the playoffs in 2000 and 2002, they wouldn't win a playoff series again until 2005, long after Payton had been traded in the deal that brought Ray Allen to Seattle. That 2004-05 team, which unexpectedly won the Northwest Division Championship with McMillan as head coach, beat the Sacramento Kings in the first round before taking the San Antonio Spurs to six games. Storm guard Sue Bird was in the crowd for the decisive Game 6.
A bunch of us were in a suite for one of those big games. If memory serves, it was Manu killed us.
Sue's memory is correct. Ginobili's drive set up Tim Duncan's game-winning basket. The Sonics still had a chance with a few seconds left at the other end, but Ray Allen's three, which looked online, rattled off, and San Antonio won the series. Here's forward Rashard Lewis, an all-star that season.
You were such a young team, and... We took the Spurs to Game 6,
yeah.
Which I think they won it that year. Did they win it that year?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was a point where the Spurs was dominant. If
yes.
It wasn't the Spurs, it was the Lakers. It was the championship. The trophy was going back and forth between those two teams. And, you know, even though we lost in the second round, but even though we was upset about losing, but we felt like we competed.
Yeah.
With such a young team, we went out there and competed against those guys. And we felt – obviously we didn't feel good about losing the series. But we felt good about going into the summer and going into next year that we competed, took the best team and one of the best teams in the NBA to six games.
The Sonics couldn't sustain that success, and they'd never again make the playoffs in Seattle. But plenty more on that to come. In the year 2000, the Sonics were joined by a second basketball team at Key Arena when the WNBA expanded to Seattle. With no players as yet, head coach Lynn Dunn became the face of the new organization. She found a market ripe to support women's basketball.
I think when I first came to Seattle in the August of 1999, I realized how excited the city and the fans were to have a WNBA team. And I think some of that carried over from the fact they had an ABL team. You know, I think it was the Seattle Reign.
The ABL was a rival pro women's basketball league that ran for two-plus seasons before folding in December 1998.
And you still had those fans that were that loved women's basketball. You had the University of Washington, who had been a power in women's basketball. So it was a perfect opportunity or in a perfect place too, to place a team. So right from the get-go, the day that I dribbled through the city of Seattle, 5.5 miles, and saw how excited the fans were that we were going to get a franchise was another reminder to me that we were in a great location.
Key Arena played host as the Storm announced the team's name and then commenced the inaugural season.
Of course, I remember the very beginning of the Seattle Storm, the night that we had the the fans come and we announce the name and the logo and how exciting that was and how thankful we were that the Ackerleys were so supportive of bringing a WNBA team to Seattle. And then I guess the next thing I remember would be opening night, the first time we ever played, how great the fans were.
One of Dunn's favorite memories in the building is a game that was notable for its length.
The game that I remember the most in Key Arena would be the night we played four overtimes. We ended, I think, by the time the game was over, the fans were crazy and everybody fouled out, and it was just interesting. It may still be the record for the longest game in the WNBA. I don't know if anybody's broken that record. So
they haven't. It's still the longest game in WNBA history. Dunn drafted Lauren Jackson number one overall in 2001 and Sue Bird with the first pick the following year. During Bird's rookie season, the Storm played the I-5 rival Portland Fire in a crucial game with a playoff spot on the line. Here's Bird.
Yeah, that was crazy because obviously, you know, with Portland just being down the street, you know, they had a lot of fans. The setup for the game was, had playoff implications. So it was not only was it our, I-5 rival, but it was also a very important game in order to make the playoffs. It was pretty much a must-win, if memory serves. One of us, whoever won that kind of had, even though you had to do more, but whoever won that had a leg up. I forgot about that game. That was a long time ago. That was an amazing experience because that was, I don't know if the upper bowl was sold out, but it was definitely sold out in the lower bowl.
Because Sue is so modest, she neglected to mention that she scored 33 points, still a career high, to help the Storm win that game. Dunn thought it was crucial for the franchise to make the playoffs so quickly.
That was a real key moment for our team, you know, to say, okay, we're really doing this. You know, we win this game, and now we're in the playoffs. You know, we're not ready to challenge for a championship, but we're on track to do what we want to do to build a world championship team in Seattle.
2 years later, with Ann Donovan replacing Dunn on the sidelines, the Storm reached the WNBA Finals for the first time. When the team returned home for Game 2 of the series against the Connecticut Sun, they were greeted by the largest crowd in franchise history, a full sellout of Key Arena. Here's Bird.
Whether you're running out for, you know, introductions, or you're running out for warm-ups, when this place is full and loud, I mean, it is a... You feel it on the inside, you know, it's like palpable. It's pretty incredible. And that's probably one of my favorite parts about Key Arena, to be honest. In all of our playoff runs that we've ever had, you know, taking the floor for the first time and hearing the crowd go crazy, that's my favorite part.
Here's Mike Tebow, who is coaching Connecticut, on the crowd.
You know, the other thing I remember, and you know, I get reminded every time we come here, is that how loud the building is, how good the fans are. This is an unbelievable environment to play a playoff game. It's deafening.
Despite the large, loud crowd, Connecticut had a chance to win the game in the series when Nikisha Sales got a wide-open shot in the corner in the closing seconds. Tebow again.
I remember sitting there on the bench when the ball was being passed to Nikisha Sales on the baseline, and Ann Donovan actually echoed it later. I thought, we're going to win. And then we didn't.
Behind 23 points from Betty Lennox, who was named MVP after leading the Storm in scoring all three games in the series, the Storm won Game 3 by a 74-60 to final at the Key to bring the city of Seattle its first major professional sports championship since the Sonics had won the title 25 years earlier. Bird.
To win a championship on your home floor and share that with your fans is incredible.
Kelly remembers that team.
And you know that they, like the Sonics, had personalities. I mean, Sue's my favorite athlete ever in the history of Seattle. She's just a great human being. Lauren Jackson was like kind of a Gary Payton, Sean Kemp hybrid. And that was, I mean, it was, and you know, Ann Donovan was the coach and what a great coach she was. There was something about that team that kind of fit with what Sonic teams were. Except that they won. That's where they screwed it up. It was a perfect story, and then they won.
After winning the championship, the Storm wouldn't win another playoff series for 6 years. But surprisingly, those first-round exits provided some of Bird's favorite memories of the Key Arena crowd.
And I remember, you know, some tough losses where no matter what, the fans always had our back. We lost to Houston in a tough game in 2005, I believe. And, you know, nobody left the building, even though the game was pretty much out of reach. So
in 2010, the Storm broke through again. That team never lost at Key Arena, going 17-0 during the regular season and then sweeping the entire playoffs to finish a record 21-0 at home. This time, the Storm hoisted the trophy in Atlanta before returning home for a parade and championship celebration at the Key the following day. After going through a rebuilding process that brought the Storm two more number one overall picks in Jewel Lloyd and Brianna Stewart to team with Bird, the Storm rose up in 2018, recording the league's best record as Stewart was named MVP. The team's playoff run was highlighted by a deciding Game 5 in the semifinals against the rival Phoenix Mercury, who had never lost a winner-take-all game with Diana Taurasi on the roster. Behind Bird's 14 points in the fourth quarter, the Storm came from behind to knock out Phoenix and advance to the finals. Here's Coach Dan Hughes after that game on the impact of the crowd.
Oh, I thought it was unlike any moment I've had as far as understanding a building in harmony with a team. I can't imagine. Even when we were down, like I looked up, we were down about 9 or something. And you would have sworn that we were rolling, you know? And I'm looking at the crowd and I'm watching how they didn't just engage the moments where, you know, that the Storm was doing good. They engaged the moments where they wanted us to do good. And it was loud, and there's no doubt that that's a motivating factor, you know, when you're talking about as many games as we played. And you know, coming back home, and I just said to the team this morning, I said, you know, when we started this journey April 29th, you know, now we're here. Now we got a chance at Key Arena with our fans to win one game and go to the finals. And it's, you know, they're a part of what we're doing, and we certainly share this moment with that crowd today because it meant a lot.
The Storm sent out Key Arena in championship fashion, getting another sweep against the Washington Mystics after winning the first two games in Seattle. The final Storm event in Key Arena was another parade that culminated with a party in the Key. Just like 2004 and 2010, Dunn was watching and celebrating the team she'd helped start from afar, though this time with a heavy heart after Donovan passed away during the 2018 season.
To see them win the championship, I think it was the fifth year maybe. And that was pretty much what I thought after we got Lauren and Sue, that by year 5 we could be challenging for a championship. And, you know, and I think about Ann Donovan, and I think about her contribution to the Storm and, you know, picking up where I left off and taking them to a championship. It's unfortunate that she's wasn't here this, you know, this time around to celebrate this latest championship. And, you know, I was thrilled for them. I was cheering for them all the way, and I'll always have a piece of my heart with that team.
Kelly, who's seen it all in Seattle sports, sees a bright future for the Storm's young core.
This iteration is going to be, it's going to be around a while. These guys are going to win some championships, some more championships.
You might not remember that Key Arena played host to another championship team. Before the Storm filled summer dates at the Key, the Ackerleys filled that part of the schedule with the Seattle Sea Dogs of the Continental Indoor Soccer League. Current Sounders manager Brian Schmetzer was a player for the Sea Dogs before transitioning to being an assistant coach under Fernando Clavijo during the team's first year at Key Arena. He recalls what it was like playing soccer at the Key.
Key Arena was a good venue. I mean, they had, I remember it was, you know, for to get the hockey, the soccer, the indoor soccer field in there, they pushed some of the stands on one of the ends out underneath to make it long enough to have, you know, a full-size, you know, hockey rink, soccer field there. And they didn't take away from any of the sight lines, the fans. I mean, the fans seemed to be right on top of us. You know, the year we won the championship the last year, there were a couple sizable crowds in there, you know, 6,000, 8,000, 10,000 people. And it was good. The atmosphere was good.
While Key Arena was being renovated, the Sea Dogs played their first season in the smaller, older Mercer Arena on the Seattle Center campus, which made the Key look great by comparison.
It seemed like you were in a bigger building, newer building, more modern building, for sure, in Key Arena.
After two below 500 seasons, the Sea Dogs upgraded their roster in 1997 and won the West with a 21-7 record. They swept their way to the two-game CISL finals, where Schmetzer credits the ownership group with providing a key assist.
You know, that final series with Houston was kind of won on logistics. So we had played them in Seattle, And those were the days where you had to play back-to-back some nights. And so we played in Seattle on a Saturday, and then we flew to Houston on Sunday for the second game of the home-and-home series. And we got to fly on the Sonics jet. So we left right after the game. We ended up getting into Houston at, you know, whatever, 3 in the morning, you know, whatever it was, get to our hotel, get a good night or whatever possible chance of sleep you could get. And they had to take a commercial flight. They didn't get in until 7 in the morning, 8 o'clock, you know, get into their beds, try and sleep a couple hours, and had to play Sunday at like 6 o'clock. So our preparation for that game on the Sunday was way better. And we ended up winning that game, I think, like 6-1. It was a, you know, it was a pretty resounding result for us.
Schmetzer is actually underselling it. The final was 7-1. Either way, the celebration was on. Eventually.
So we were obviously all excited to be on an NBA plane. I mean, it was nice, and, you know, God bless our owners for letting us do that and helping us win a championship. But after the game, we were, you know, kind of debating, okay, should we celebrate a little bit? Sure, there was some champagne in the locker room, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, some of the guys wanted to have a few beers on the plane on the way back. And so John Dreisel.
Dreisel was president of the Sonics and the Sea Dogs at the time.
Bill Ackerley, a couple of those guys, we stopped off at like a store on the way to the Houston Hobby Airport.
Like a convenience store?
Yeah, like a convenience store. And, you know, it was taking a little bit long to get a couple cases of beer for the plane ride home. And, you know, we could see the body language through the window of the bus in the store, like, you know, something's not right. And so Fernando has to come out and, you know, come onto the bus and say, look, the credit cards aren't working. You know, we need to come up with some cash to buy the beer. And so we were given John Dreisel and Bill and I think Ted and Chris were on.
Those are two other members of the Ackerley family that own the team.
Playing, we were like giving them grief, saying, you guys, your credit cards don't work. You know, you guys can't even buy beer for the team. Well, the credit card reader was broken, you know, in the convenience store, but it made for a good storyline. And I remember everybody being really super happy. Obviously, on the ride home, we got some really, you know, nice rings. I have a nice championship ring with a Sea Dog on it. I mean, the Ackerleys treated us very well.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the Sea Dogs would never get a chance to defend their championship. The CISL folded months later, bringing an end to the chapter of soccer at Key Arena.
I mean, I thought we had, Seattle was one of the, you know, better franchises in that league. So it was very disappointing, but, you know, I understood it because I'd been around soccer in this country and in Seattle for quite some time. So, you know, I got it, but it was disappointing for sure.
Though Key Arena wasn't designed for hockey, we'll explain why later, the WHL's Seattle Thunderbirds called the arena home from 1995 through 2008 when they moved to the Showair Center in the nearby suburb of Kent. In 1997, their second season in the Key, the Thunderbirds reached the WHL Finals before losing 4-0 to Lethbridge. Later, Key Arena would play host to Seattle University men's basketball upon the Redhawks' return to Division I. Besides numerous concerts, Key Arena was the site of the Washington State Boys Basketball Tournament through 2000, the 2017 WNBA All-Star Game, hosted the Pac-12 Women's Basketball Tournament from 2013 through 2018, the 2013 NCAA Women's Volleyball Final Four, won by Penn State, and the NCAA Men's Basketball Sub-Regionals three times, most notably in 1999. That year, 14th seed Weber State pulled off one of the tournament's biggest upsets ever, beating number 3 seed North Carolina 76-74 behind 36 points from Harold "The Show" Arsenault. But it was another underdog at Key Arena whose success had more staying power.
You know, one of the things I think about a lot.
This is Kelly again.
Is that Gonzaga started its run at Key Arena. You know, they beat Minnesota and beat Stanford. And it's been like a home for them.
All right, let's back up a second. Right now, you probably think of Gonzaga as this power that reached the championship game and is a perennial NCAA tournament fixture. But that wasn't the case in 1999, just their second NCAA tournament appearance ever.
They were a cute little team, you know, and they...
Gonzaga was the number 10 seed in 1999, but caught a couple of huge breaks. The first was playing in Seattle, a 5-hour drive from the Gonzaga campus in Spokane and home to plenty of GU alumni. The second came the morning of their opening game, when number 7 seed Minnesota had 4 players suspended after a report of academic fraud. Gonzaga won 75-63, setting up a second-round matchup against Pac-10 champion Stanford. Now, this was a legitimate upset, as number 10 Gonzaga toppled number 2 Stanford 82-74. Gonzaga would then edge out number 6 seed Florida 73-72 in a subsequent round to reach the regional final before finally losing 67-62 to top-seeded UConn on the verge of the Final Four. Despite the departure of Coach Jan Monson, who went, ironically, to Minnesota after the Gophers fired Coach Clem Haskins for his role in the scandal, Gonzaga kept the run going under former assistant coach Mark Few, who eventually took the program to new heights. In 2003, Seattle became a home for Gonzaga, which began playing annually at Key Arena for the so-called Battle in Seattle, beating number 3 Missouri 87-80 in overtime that year. One of the most memorable battles in Seattle came in 2005, when star Adam Morrison delivered one of the signature shots of his memorable career, banking in a three at the buzzer to beat Oklahoma State 64-62.
The Oklahoma State players were just, that ball can't go in.
3 years later, the battle in Seattle brought number 2 UConn to Seattle to face Gonzaga, which was ranked 8th at the time. Despite a snowstorm that hit Seattle as part of that winter's snowpocalypse, the game drew a sellout crowd, including storm guard Sue Bird, a UConn alum.
Yeah, I came to the UConn-Gonzaga game, and that was the first time where anybody has booed me in this building. I was not happy about that. All the Gonzaga fans booed me. That was not cool. And they like were like, oh, Sue Bird from the University of Connecticut. They did that on purpose. And it was boo. And I was like, this is bullshit. Well, we had the last laugh on that one. Yeah. We won that game. So yeah, that was the only time I was booed in here. Hopefully it never happens again.
Indeed, UConn won an overtime thriller 88-83. Key Arena hasn't always been kind to Gonzaga. When they returned for the 2004 NCAA tournament, the Zags were stunned by number 10 seed Nevada as the second seed in the reverse of their 1999 upset. But Gonzaga returned to the Key for the NCAA tournament in 2015 as a powerful number 2 seed en route to the Elite Eight.
What they've done is spectacular, and I think us living in Seattle, we got to see some of the best parts of it. The last regional here, they beat Iowa in the second round. I forget who they played in this first round, but they mopped the floor with both of them.
There were many great memories at Key Arena, but given how quickly the renovation went wrong, it's worth looking back to ask why that happened. Let's start with Kelly's hard-earned cynicism.
The way I feel is, and the 1996 finals with Chicago really proved it, was that Key Arena was obsolete the day they opened the doors. And here we are in the finals, and Chicago's playing in the new United Center, and you could put Key Arena inside of it. And there were all kinds of food kiosks and, you know, way better food than we get. And, you know, the last year, was it 3 years ago that the NCAA tournament was here? Everybody was laughing at the arena, like the teeny little bar in the second level, and had two TV sets from 1956, and they were laughing at them. And I said, look, we just got color about 2 years ago. It's been black and white.
The small size of Key Arena was a constant issue. Here's Wally Walker with a couple of examples.
You know, everything was small at Key Arena by definition. In fact, it turned out that the visitors' locker room was below NBA code. And a wall had to be taken out just to make it, you know, up to whatever the specifications of the NBA. You know, ours was small. I think we did a lot with, you know, very little in the way of resources. And it was certainly comfortable and nicely appointed. But everything was small. And so it was part of the deal. We tried to make it part of the charm, but maybe some others, you know, thought otherwise. The fans had intimate experience. The players did too. they were on top of each other, so you couldn't help but talk with each other or know what everyone's business was. And that probably was with the right group of guys and a good team. That's a positive. With the wrong group, not so much. And I've seen both in my 22 years in the NBA. Another little quirk about the building: the announced capacity was 17,072. Everyone remembers that number because that was a sellout. It was always announced.
Yeah, I have that memorized.
Yeah. Well, guess what? We counted the seats because we were talking about doing a remodel, and we were trying to get actual, absolute, sure number for how many seats there were. There were not 17,072. There were like 16,300. So I said to the city, who was our partner in the building, who came up with the 17,000 number? Because there aren't that many. So when we had a sellout, by the time you have comp seats and you take care of the people that need to come with the player comps, and you have seats for the media, et cetera. Really, a sellout for us was about 15,000 tickets sold. Well, that put us for tickets sold, that put us at the extreme mm-hmm. bottom of the NBA for capacity at a time when we had good teams. Obviously, we could have sold a lot more tickets.
Mm-hmm. To understand why this was the case, it's necessary to go back and look at how and why Key Arena was renovated in the first place. When Bob Whitsitt was hired as Sonics president in 1986, he inherited an aging Seattle Center Coliseum and a relationship with the city of Seattle that was in little better condition.
Well, the first thing when I got there, the team had a very acrimonious relationship with the city, and the team was terrible. They kind of dismantled a really good team and had a bad team, and they had the lowest attendance in the NBA and went to give playoff dates, and they wouldn't even give me playoff dates for the first round for you know, the season starts like 4 or 5 months later, and I told them, you know, we got to have some playoff dates for the end of the season. They said, you guys stink. You never make the playoffs. You don't, you know, a lot of negativity. And I said, well, league rule, we got to have some playoff dates, you know, certainly for the first round. And that was the year they truly never gave us home playoff dates. And not only did we make the playoffs the first year, we had to play our first round over at the University of Washington at the Heck Ed Pavilion. And we beat the highly ranked Dallas Mavericks.
This was tied for the biggest upset in NBA playoff history until 1994 when, well, you know.
And then the city said, oh, shit, we'll let you in the second round. So we got the second round in the Coliseum. And then we punched out Olajuwon and the Rockets. And then they certainly gave us playoff dates to play the Lakers in the conference finals. But point was, not only did the building have some massive needs for capital improvements, as quote a prime tenant, we could barely even get dates in the building because things weren't going very well. And then we had times throughout that tenure where, you know, games would be delayed because obviously it rains in Seattle and the roof would leak and water would get on the court, or, you know, fill in your various war stories. But you know,
this sounds like a joke, but it's not. In 1986, the Sonics actually had a game canceled by rain because of a leak in the roof.
It was an old building that was, you know, not in disrepair, but it wasn't maintained probably at the level that the city and the tenant would like it to be maintained, because, you know, it takes a bit of money to do that kind of thing. So I think, you know, there was a, you know, lots of meetings, lots of trying to figure out how to move forward. And it culminated with kind of the remodel, if you will, of the Coliseum back in whenever that was, the early 90s.
The Sonics' first plan was to build a new arena of their own in, ironically enough, if you've followed the arena debate over the past 6 years, SoDo.
I negotiated a deal with Burlington Northern, and we got the property, which is now the site where Safeco sits. And we got pretty far down the line. We teamed up with a company called Spectacor out of Philadelphia. They manage a lot of facilities. We got real close to doing that deal. The owner at the time, once we got to the starting gate, we did everything we were supposed to do. He just didn't have the money. So literally, I was in his office one day, and he hadn't told me he was going to pull the plug on the project, and he was selling the property to some business guy who was going to, you know, develop office buildings or something down there. Literally, he had the agreement on his desk. And I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I can't do the project. I'm selling it. And I go, God, it took me like, you know, forever to get Burlington Northern to sell the property to us. And they did it for one reason only, kind of as a community thing, to let us build the arena. And so I told him, I said, well, all you want is money, right? He goes, yeah. I said, would you mind if I call the county up and see if they would buy the land back, buy it from us? But long story short, the county kind of matched the offer, if you will. And our owner, Barry Ackerley, was the owner at the time. He didn't care who he sold it to. He just wanted to get money. So we sold it to the county, which turned out to be a great thing, because without having that chunk of land, the Kingdome site alone would not have accommodated the two stadiums. So that piece that would have been the arena turned out to be extremely valuable for the county and for the local government to figure out our long-term solution for both the Mariners and the Seahawks. So it was just kind of a stroke of luck, if you will, that that worked out that way. But I happened to be in his office on the right day, I guess. And, you know, it's one of those little pieces that nobody will ever think about, but it was it really made the puzzle work years later.
When the Soto plan fell through, the Sonics returned to the idea of renovating the Coliseum.
It was kind of like a plan B. We couldn't build our own arena, so we started those discussions up. And we'd had those discussions on and off for quite a few years, frankly.
In May 1993, the Seattle City Council approved by a 7-2 vote a $74 million renovation to be funded by revenue from the arena. There was some dissent. Council member Jim Street, one of the two no votes, expressed concern about the unwillingness of the Sonics to sign a 20-year lease that would last as long as the city's bonds paying for the arena. Nevertheless, the deal was done, and by the night of the 1994 draft, Kelly remembers hearing and fearing wrecking balls.
I remember the funniest thing about it. It was, I think the wrecking ball first hit the night of the draft when Wally Walker turned down the Scottie Pippen, Sean Kemp trade.
This trade came very close to happening, and it's one of the great what-ifs in NBA history, given that these two teams faced each other in the NBA Finals 2 years later.
And so after the draft was over, George Karl and Gerg...
That's longtime assistant coach Tim Gergerich.
And I... There's a back entrance into their offices off of the center, and we went in there, and honest to God, you can hear the wrecking ball, and you can see the dust coming down the hallway, and, you know, I'm thinking... Maybe we should get out of here. You know, I don't know where that ball is going to hit next. And they were, both of them were just fuming about not getting the trade done. And
so the renovated Key Arena opens in 1995. But as Walker points out, the investment still wasn't enough to put it on par with other arenas around the league. By comparison to the $74 million investment in renovations, for example, Portland's Rose Garden opened the same year at a cost of $262 million, and the United Center that Kelly mentioned as a contrast during the 1996 NBA Finals was built a year before for $175 million.
Yeah, there wasn't much capital to do the renovation. A lot was done with really $70 million. There was some other in-kind contribution, but the remodel, finished in 95, was really just over $70 million. That was efficiently done, but you didn't get the size and scale. And then after that, there wasn't the capital, which was what we were trying to do when we were down in Olympia, the city council, 04, 05, 06, get some more capital to upgrade the building. But there wasn't any, and it's a city-owned building. It just, there wasn't a way, and there wasn't access to the resources to bring it up to NBA scale when payrolls, like I said, jumped within 5 years. There just wasn't a commensurate investment to keep that building current.
Now here Walker introduces the second problem with Key Arena, the lease. Because the renovations were funded by income from the arena, that limited how much the Sonics could earn from games.
Yeah, a couple of things. When we sold out every game, the capacity was small. If it wasn't the smallest in the NBA at that time, it was the second smallest. But when you're selling it out, that did cover some of the economic shortcomings of the deal. But also what changed very quickly, and I'll give you some data, was the economics of the NBA and the team payrolls. Our payroll in 1996, the first year in the building when we had the team went to the finals and the 10th best record in the regular season, was $23 million. That was about the average payroll. I know, it's laughable now. Within 5 years, we're in the same building, the team isn't as good, and the average NBA payroll is over twice that. It's $50 million. Well, that wasn't anticipated by anybody, that quick escalation, and the building didn't support the ticket revenue, even if we did sell out, to support that big jump in payroll.
You remember in the beginning when I said how nice and new Key Arena seemed when I first walked in? Well, that wasn't the whole story. The rest of that thought was, if Key Arena is this nice, imagine how amazing the Mariners' new ballpark will be when it opens. Another strike against Key Arena came a few years later when Safeco Field, and later CenturyLink Field, opened across town. These were truly first-class stadiums, built with extensive public financing, and their suites and clubs were far more luxurious for fans paying the highest ticket prices than what the Sonics could provide.
What hurt us was the courtside ticket, which are very expensive, and really support the rest of the arena. You can afford to offer $10 seats to get in the building, which we love doing, to have fans who couldn't afford courtside seats, and most can't.
That's where I was sitting.
Well, I know, and I would have been too as a kid. Actually, for the Philadelphia 76ers, that's exactly where I was sitting when I was a kid. But to support the economics of a team, you got to sell expensive courtside seats. We had approximately 500 courtside seats. We had a courtside club for them, which is an amenity. Amenity is a loaded word, but it's an amenity that the people that are willing to pay that much for a ticket really need to have. They need a place to go to have dinner, to entertain. And the Diamond Club comes along at Safeco, and everything's included in the ticket price. Well, it's not really free food because it's built into the price of the ticket, of course. Everyone knows that on one hand. On the other hand, it kind of feels that way. You go there, and you're not worried about, you know, getting a check to hurry down to see the game. And, well, the Courtside Club was a beautiful, smallish room that seated 100. We had 500 courtside ticket holders. So we couldn't offer free food because we'd have to turn away 400 people. So it would be reservations, pay for it. Well, it just wasn't as good an experience as fans started experiencing at the Diamond Club when it was all included. They were still getting great seats. And we heard that. We heard the people, well, the Diamond Club, everything's included, and I come here and I can't get a reservation, and then the buffet is expensive, and I don't get it. So that was a factor.
Barely 5 years after Key Arena opened, it was obvious to Walker as he helped put together the ownership group led by Howard Schultz that would buy the Sonics from the Ackerleys that something needed to change with the arena and lease, and soon.
I remember communicating with prospective investors because we were out raising money starting in late 2000 and the deal closed in early 2001, to say that, hey, our arena deal isn't as good as the rest of the leagues. It's a challenge. We've dealt with that challenge for a while now. We'll continue to do our best. We're not going to have a real high payroll, but we think we can be competitive even with an average or below average NBA payroll, which is where we were. That was the hand we were dealt, and that's what we did. But that we were going to have to, at some point, our lease was up in 2010. We all knew that. And we were going to have to figure out, you know, a solution with a better economic deal. And I don't know if we talked specifically about a remodel at that point to make it a bigger building. But we knew that within, you know, kind of 5 years, we were going to be, you know, working on it.
The first I remember hearing about Key Arena renovations came in a February 2002 column by Blaine Newnham of the Seattle Times, who quoted Schultz saying he was, quote, envious of new arenas around the league. At that point, the idea that something needed to be done with Key Arena seemed preposterous. And indeed, Walker, now elevated to team president, found the idea that something was wrong with Key Arena difficult to sell.
It was really an issue because we're talking about the politics and we're laying out all the numbers. A compelling one, we thought, was the fact if we sold every ticket to every game in that building with the way the deal was constructed with the city, we would still be at the very low end of NBA revenue. In other words, we were at 100% capacity. Every ticket sold for every game, we'd be at the bottom end in revenue. Well, that's not a good model. That doesn't work when you're trying to have enough money to have a contending team. So as you go out to try to tell a story, and if you use the word amenities for what the premium seat ticket holders really require, it's not a good word for asking for public money, which we were at the time, to say, I don't know if there's a better way to say it. Maybe there was, but it didn't resonate. I'll tell you that for sure. The other thing we came up against was what you referenced. Fans like the intimacy. They like the good sight lines. They liked it being smallish because they felt like they were right on top of the court. So you didn't get a groundswell from many, if not most, diehard fans because they said, hey, I like going to games there.
By the mid-2000s, both the Sonics and the city of Seattle were losing money on Key Arena, and they looked to the Washington State Legislature for a bailout. They proposed extending the King County hotel and sales taxes used to fund the construction of Safeco Field and CenturyLink Field, and using the revenue generated once those facilities were paid off to pay off bonds for another renovation that would cost an estimated $180 million and double Key Arena in size. Redirecting the tax revenue required the approval of the state legislature, a process Walker knew would take years to complete.
There were some great advocates for what we were doing, both on the city council and in Olympia, both, because at that point we needed help from the politicians at Olympia because it was based on taxes. Any change in a tax policy requires the politicians in Olympia. So we were going down there. I was going down there more than I would have liked. And there was some political pushback, which is normal in those situations. We understood that. But we thought we were making progress. We started going down in December of 2004. I remember that because one of those early trips, I took Lauren Jackson from the Storm down. The Storm had just won their first WNBA championship. So Lauren, Karen Bryant, and I drove down to Olympia to start meeting the politicians down there. And we got a decent reception. It was late in the legislative year. The legislature here just meets from kind of January through March. They were around when we went down in December, but they weren't actually in session. But we knew we were starting pretty late, and we weren't going to get something passed that year. But the Mariners had taken 3 years. It just is a three-year process. We had to get out ahead and at least plant the seed that, hey, here are requirements. Here's why we're so far behind, and here's what we're going to be asking for. So we started that without an expectation in year one, or for that matter, year two. The problem came in, even with some support from some politicians, not all, and I'll get back to that. In year two, we had people in our ownership group specifically get impatient. We always thought it was a three-year process. In year two, there were some hands thrown up in the air saying, I can't stand this. I've had enough. They're not listening. They don't get it. You know, we're done. Well, that was wrong because it had to be a three-year process. And so had we been going down the following year, which then would have been 07, we still would have had 3 years left on our lease, and we would have had time to get something done. Obviously, it didn't turn out that way.
Wally's not going to point fingers, but that impatience in the ownership group, it came from the most important member, majority owner and chairman Howard Schultz. During February 2006, the week the Seahawks were playing in their first Super Bowl, Schultz tried to carve out space on the sports pages with a tone-deaf warning about the Sonics' future. I must say, I'm really not optimistic, Schultz said in the media room before a game. We've done everything we possibly could do to demonstrate our passionate commitment to the city, the state, our fan base, and it's going on deaf ears. The fact that not all Seattle politicians were united behind the Sonics proposal surely added to Schultz's frustration. Here's Walker again.
And going back, the other thing that changed was the first year we went down, the mayor's office supported us and was right behind us. And we laid out the same scenario. Hey, this is a three-year process. You're our partner. Well, the following year, whatever political calculus by the mayor and his staff decided that it wasn't a good issue, and they weren't going to be supporting us as we went down in year two, which was then the 2006 session. And so we had people in our ownership group rightfully going crazy, which is, where's our partner? They're the ones that operate the building. They own the building, and we're going down trying to get some political help, which helps them, and the mayor's not there. Well, we went ahead anyway, and we got the King County executive, Ron Sims. I met with him in early January of that year saying, okay, we're getting no cooperation from the mayor's office. Would you be on board? And he was. So kudos to Executive Sims. And really then we started the process, and then the mayor's office in the form of Tim Cease, the deputy mayor, did finally come down a couple months later, I think because it was in motion and they felt like they had to get on board the train, but they didn't really get on board as early as they should have.
It's worth explaining here that one issue the Sonics ran into was the way both the Mariners and the Seahawks had been saved from movie at the 11th hour. Safeco Field actually lost a public vote in September 1995 before being approved by the state legislature after the team's miracle run to the ACLS that season. And the Seahawks had moving vans ready to take them to Los Angeles before the NFL and the team's lease to play at the Kingdome prevented it. The expectation was the same thing would happen with the Sonics, that they'd have to threaten to leave Seattle in order to get any traction politically. That ended up a key miscalculation.
We didn't want to be in that situation where we were going to take it, use a brinksmanship and take it and have to bluff about something. And so we tried to get out ahead of that by starting what we thought was early. It's not a winning political issue. It's, you know, it's controversial. In general, not always in every city, but I think the political calculation was, hey, this is not something we want to get involved in unless we absolutely have to. And of course, our view was they had to. I think their view was, you know, let's delay, let's procrastinate and kind of see what happens.
And maybe it'll be someone else's problem.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe something will get resolved without us having to use any political capital.
And then by the time they realized the urgency after the sale, at that point, it was too late.
It was too late. And then we go and have a lawsuit where some of us, myself included, were involved in that too. And at that point, you know, Mayor Nichols in his office, you know, did try to fight it until they didn't, until they basically, you know, settled the lawsuit, which, you know, was also a mistake.
Let's back up a second because we skipped a key step in the process. The sale of the Sonics in July 2006 to an ownership group from Oklahoma City, which not so coincidentally had an NBA-ready arena and had acquired a taste for pro basketball by hosting the New Orleans Hornets when they were displaced after Hurricane Katrina. News of the sale actually broke just before the storm played a matinee Kids Day game at Key Arena, leaving reporters' attention divided. Here's Kelly's memory of that day.
You know, we sort of felt something was coming, but at the Storm game that afternoon, the Storm had a game that afternoon before the press conference. We didn't know about the press conference. We were told about it at Key Arena. And it was, I think the way it was presented to us was, this is going to be there's a big, good announcement coming from the Sonics. And, you know, boy, I didn't see this coming. So the poor Storm were playing this game that nobody on press row cared about. And we all go over to the practice facility across the street. And there's balloons and gold sneakers, and, you know, it was, and it just didn't, it was out of place for sure. And it took about, it took about 30 seconds for it all to kind of coalesce into, they're done. He's selling them to a guy from Oklahoma City who wants a team and the NBA says deserves a team. And he's saying, this is the best thing for Seattle. Howard Schultz saying that. And then he got off the podium, and I don't know how many, maybe 10 guys are around him. We're asking him more questions. And Howard, who is a cool dude, he had flop sweat like he looked like Don Rickles. And, I mean, it was a mournful day. And on the practice court at their facility, they if you had walked in, you would have thought, this is the most wonderful day in Sonic history.
Part of Schultz's logic for selling the team was that an out-of-town ownership group might more credibly use the threat of leaving against local politicians. A clause in the deal required the new owners to spend a year using good faith best efforts to build a new arena or renovate the Key. Led by new chairman Clayton Bennett, the Sonics proposed a grandiose $500 million arena in the suburb of Renton. The plan never stood much of a chance in legislature, and in November 2007, Bennett announced the team's intention to move to Oklahoma City as soon as allowed by the Sonics' Key Arena lease, which had two additional years remaining. As Walker mentioned, Nichols directed a lawsuit intended to enforce the lease. The discovery period of that lawsuit yielded to emails among Sonics owners that undercut the idea they ever had any intention of keeping the team in Seattle. With their future in limbo, the Sonics were suffering through a 20-62 season, the worst in franchise history. Kelly.
And then, you know, that last year was just a death march. Yeah. And you're watching the next greatest player to come along, Kevin Durant, and you know he's not going to be here.
The city's lawsuit against the Sonics went to trial, but on the afternoon Judge Marsha Peckman was to issue her ruling, July 2nd, the two sides instead announced a settlement. The team would be free to move to Oklahoma City immediately, paying $45 million to the city to break their lease and an additional $30 million if the Washington State Legislature approved $75 million in funding for a Key Arena renovation and Seattle didn't get a team within 5 years. The Oklahoma City ownership group knew Washington State politics well enough to know that possibility never stood a chance. The legislature took no action. Kelly couldn't believe the city settled.
That's the thing. It's almost like fans are more sophisticated than the politicians, because, you know, God, Greg Nichols saying, well, the only way we're ever going to get team back is if we let the Sonics go without, you know, without fighting it anymore. How naive do you think? You think David Stern would ever think, oh, that's right, we got to get another team in there because they didn't hassle us anymore.
And so, after 41 years, the Sonics had left Seattle. While the Storm remained at Key Arena as an anchor tenant, soon joined by Seattle U during the winter, the arena felt incomplete without the Sonics playing 41 times a year. Here's Walker.
Yeah, it feels empty in a lot of ways, not just without the banners, but of course you don't have sellouts there, you know, very often, except for kind of a special event. So you don't have that hot building. You go to a college game there, and it's still a nice place to watch a game, but you don't have that sold-out, great electric feeling of the fans so involved in the game. So the atmosphere has been lost for the most part, not for the Storm. They're still doing great, and evidence is pretty high. It's a really good home court for them, But it just doesn't feel the same. And of course, without the income coming into the operator of the building, he was a city all those years, the building has deteriorated a fair amount. And so it's not a great experience.
Kelly echoes that sentiment.
And I hate driving past that place every day because it reminds me of what we used to have. And every time I've gone in there, I don't care if it's Bruce Springsteen or Sue Bird, I'm thinking about everything else that we had and lost, and how now we still don't know if we're ever going to get NBA team back. So it's that. And, you know, I would go to, I remember going to a game on Sunday, might even been after a Seahawk game, that LeBron was like early in LeBron's career. And just thinking, how cool is this? You know, I went to an NFL game, and now I'm watching LeBron. And I just think more than anything, I miss the anticipation of game night. Being, you know, hey, because you always see something great in the NBA. So that's the part I miss the most.
You might have heard Walker mention something about banners. In January 2009, 6 months after the Sonics moved, the team's banners quietly came down from the Key Arena rafters. Gone was the 1979 NBA championship won at the Kingdom, as well as banners for the team's division and conference championships at the Key and six retired jerseys, including that of McMillan, for whom the honor was particularly special.
You know, another amazing night, you know, to, you know, be honored in such a way that, you know, normally Hall of Famers get honors like that, you know, where they have their jerseys retired. And I think all the guys who were in the rafters at that time up there, you know, Lenny and those guys, Hall of Famers and champions, and the organization and the city was, you know, really just really showing me respect that they appreciated the work that I tried to bring out and put out on the floor. And they were showing me that by honoring me with the retirement of my jersey. Unbelievable. You know, I played with some great players, and, you know, I played with the Hall of Famer and Gary Payton and, you know, Sean Kemp, unbelievable player. So just, you know, George Karl should be in the Hall of Fame. And I expect that to happen. But, you know, it was just an amazing time for me and, for my family to, you know, have spent my entire career in one city, in one uniform, and which was a great city and a great sports city.
In a quirk of fate, McMillan was the only player who played at Key Arena to have his jersey retired by the Sonics. Payton and Kemp are still awaiting their ceremonies, which will presumably take place once the NBA returns to Seattle. McMillan is hopeful his jersey will someday hang again.
Someone told me that they had taken the banners down and put them in a storage. And hopefully that's true. And when Seattle gets their team again, get an NBA team again, maybe they can dust them off and put them back up.
Now, Key Arena's days are numbered. A decade after the Sonics moved, the city of Seattle has approved a plan by the Oakview Group to rebuild the arena, digging down again and expanding the footprint of the building south to make room for a bowl suitable for hockey. Oh, right, about that. The reason the Key didn't work for hockey? It was a stipulation by then-Sonics owner Barry Ackerley, Witsit says.
No, that was an absolute edict by the owner. The city, I remember being in a couple of meetings, the city rightfully so wanted the building to work for both the NBA and the NHL. And I remember him saying, look, you've got the NBA, one in the hand versus, what's the saying, one in the hand, two in the bush, whatever it was. And he didn't want the competition. He didn't want another winter sports team coming in. He was concerned about sponsorship dollars, ticket revenue, dates in the building, you know, all the things a tenant would put on their wish list of things they wanted. And when you're the prime tenant and really the only prime tenant, you get all those things plus more. And so, you know, I think the city probably regrets doing that, but they that's the decision they made back at that time. And so obviously the stumbling block for the NHL, not that I, you know, I can't sit here and tell you there was a groundswell of NHL people wanting to put a team in here. You know, maybe they looked at it, maybe they didn't. But once the building was built and it, I forgot what the capacity was, but, you know, I'm making this number up. Maybe it was 12,000 or something for hockey versus 17,000 for basketball. You know, whatever the numbers were, it was 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 seats less for hockey than it could have been had it been designed a little more conventionally. And then the flip side is, I think you got a few more intimate seats for basketball, which was sort of the headliner as to why those compromises were made. They were made to get even better, closer, more intimate, you know, fan experience for the NBA, which was true. But yeah, that's kind of the short version of that conversation back in the early 90s.
Given that, it's yet another irony that two of Barry's sons, Chris and Ted Ackerley, are part of the ownership group for the NHL expansion team Seattle hopes to land to play in the rebuild arena. Whitsitt is involved too. He's serving as chief sports advisor to David Bonderman, the lead investor in the hockey team. Whitsitt says one of his tasks is making sure this arena leaves room for both hockey and basketball.
I hate to use the word job. That's not probably the right way. But one of my oversights in this new project is to look at the project through the lens of both the hockey organization and an NBA organization that does not even exist, because there's a strong commitment from the city, Mr. Bonderman, the Seattle Hockey Partners, you know, OVG, everybody involved in this thing. You can talk to anybody and they will tell you that they're going to make sure it works for both the NHL and the NBA. And it's exactly the reverse of the 90s.
Construction is scheduled to begin this fall after a fitting final event. The return of NBA basketball to Key Arena for one night is the Golden State Warriors play the Sacramento Kings in a preseason game on October 5th. As we prepare to say goodbye to this version of Key Arena, those who played a role in its history have a wide range of memories. Perhaps befitting his involvement in the renovation, Whitsitt is most pragmatic.
The building has evolved, you know, many times over many years. It's just going to, you know, it's just going to be better. And it's not like I need to see the rusty pipe in section 114 or something like that. I want to see a better seat. I want to see a better amenity. So no, it's just kind of like your house is, you're not going to go in your house for a couple of years because you're making it better. But then when that house is done, you're going to be even more excited to get in it. So, I won't have that same kind of emotion. I'll have an emotion toward a next chapter of excitement that I think is the community is craving and ripe and ready for. And the fact that that can happen, I think, is going to be exciting for everybody.
No player spent as many years in Key Arena as Sue Bird, who has played all 17 seasons of her WNBA career for the Storm at the Key and knows it intimately.
You know, it's been my home for, you know, 17 seasons. And, you know, the memories that stick out are the very first time I walked in, which was I had just been drafted and the Sonics, I want to say it was a playoff game, had a playoff game with the Spurs. Yeah. So that was my first introduction to this place. And, you know, as the years have gone on, you start to learn it. You know, I know all the back, you know, hallways and rooms and tunnels. You know, you could plot me any, close my eyes, plot me anywhere in here, open them, and I'll know exactly where, you know, where to go to get to wherever. So it's nice to know a place that well.
To Lynn Dunn, the Key was an ideal home for the WNBA.
I love Key Arena. You know, Key Arena is a perfect facility for a WNBA team. You know, I don't think it's a great size. It's a great location. And then, of course, Seattle has one of the best fan bases in the whole WNBA.
Playing at the Key remains a highlight of Brian Schmetzer's long career involved with nearly every incarnation of professional soccer in the Seattle area.
You know, you go in there and it's an iconic building that has a lot of history in it. So for sure, I mean, yeah, I would always tell my buddies, yeah, we used to play in here. Yeah, this was where we won a championship. There's always those memories, yeah, especially at my age. Those are the things I'm holding on to.
Kelly's first memory of Key Arena is a complaint.
I'm going to remember like going through a section, going past people, and having those cup holders like push you into the row in front of you. I hated those. Not only that, but they didn't hold the cup. It was the craziest design I've ever seen. But that's a small point, actually, Kevin. It's nothing to worry about.
On a more serious note, he loved the atmosphere the Key created for basketball.
One thing about that arena, when there was a big game there, it felt like a big game. I mean, there was just a buzz. I think in some of these, you know, beautiful new Taj Mahal arenas, that gets lost in the size. But every great game at Key Arena had a buzz to it. And, you know, it started out in Seattle Center and just buzzed right into the arena.
That was certainly the case when the Sonics were flying high in the 1990s. Here's McMillan, part of those teams.
I thought it was a great arena for us at that time. Now it's considered a small arena and outdated, but we actually thought our arena was so good that the opponents came in. They liked it too because they would shoot well in Key Arena. But it was a very intimate building where when they dug down and went deeper to add more seats, it really allowed, it gave it a really good backdrop, depth perception for shooters and for players. It was a good shooting building. It was a great place to play. The fans were on top of you, very close to you, able to interact. And you could feel that energy because of the bowl that was created when they dug down and went a little deeper. So, when it went from the Seattle Center to Key Arena, that bowl was a little deeper. And it just gave it an intimate feeling where you felt really connected with your fan base. It was loud. You know, we were winning 50, 60 games, during the season. And just a really a tough place for opponents to come and play.
We haven't yet heard from Hersey Hawkins, who played with McMillan on the 96 Sonics team that reached the finals.
That run, you know, during the season and during the playoffs, I think that building may have been as loud as I had ever heard it. And sometimes you got chills that it was so loud.
Here's Wally Walker.
Well, it was a great home court. It was a great intimate atmosphere in which to play. Our players loved it. The opposing players hated it. And I think that was the best testament of all. The fans liked it. They were smashed in tight. There wasn't a lot of leg room. We heard some whining about that, but not much because the fans were all close, and that was by design. It was a basketball building, and that was the strength of it.
I mean, we just had a confidence in that building, and even when we played poorly, the fans kind of had a hunger to...
That's Sonics coach George Carl.
To kind of help us back, to find the energy, to come back, and they believed in us, and we believed in them, and it was a fantastic, and the energy of the building, how we played. We were a defensive team that created offense with steals, and we were athletic when we could get Sean and Gary in the game. It was pretty much when we got the game going our way, when the ball started rolling our way, we really were we had a lot of momentum type of breakouts and that were created a great deal by our defense and got our athleticism in the game.
Kelly also misses the energy of a close game at Key Arena.
If you're a basketball fan, you can forget about everything else. Once they put the ball in the air, it didn't matter anymore. And it was loud. And I just remember, fourth quarter of games when they're making a run and Stevie Ray Vaughan is playing and everybody is on their feet. I mean, that's what I miss. And it could happen any night. You never knew. And, just to think that we've been robbed of that for 10 years.
Bert is hopeful the noise and feel of Key Arena can be replicated in the new building. We'll see if she's still on the court when the Storm returns to play there in 2021.
A lot of arenas just have feels to them. I don't know how else to explain it. You walk into a building and it has a feel about it. And, there are some arenas when you walk in, you feel comfortable. It seems, you might shoot better in some places than other ones. For me, my college arena, Gampo Pavilion, no matter what, the minute I walk in that place, I just feel good. And that's how I feel about Key Arena. And, you know, I've felt that from day one, and I felt it throughout my career. And it just feels comfortable when you walk in this building. And I'm hoping that along with the fact that I was just saying this earlier, it's like there's something about the bones and the acoustics in this building where whether it's 5,000 or 15,000, it's unbelievably loud. Unbelievably loud, and it makes for such a, you know, a big time home court advantage. So, you know, I hope that those two things, you know, kind of remain when the new building is here.
We'll give the last word to Kelly, as acerbic as ever.
I think once you get into the new arena, you'll forget all about Key Arena. That's my hope.
I'd like to thank everyone who participated in this podcast for their time, as well as the PR departments of the Indiana Pacers, Seattle Sounders FC, and Seattle Storm for helping facilitate those interviews. And thank you for listening to this special episode of the Pelton Cast.